This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is recorded, however, so if you call in, no one will answer.
And welcome back to the Michigan Insider, Sports Talk 1050, WTK, the ticket online at WTK.com. Sam out for the rest of the hour. He's got somewhere to be. But I am joined now by the MGo Blog Roundtable. Craig Ross is here. Brian Cook is here. Seth was here. He disappeared. So hopefully Seth will be back soon. But good morning, Brian Cook. Craig Ross, excuse me. How are you guys?
Good. We're busy refreshing the internet about news for the basketball roster.
Well, you wrote a good article, fascinating article about that. I would commend everyone read the Athletic article today by Brendan Quinn. That's an interview with Juwan. There's a couple of things that are a little ambiguous in there that I wish he would have been clearer about. But this, I keep threatening to do this, and one of these days, like when I'm on the show by myself, which seems to happen once a year or so, I'll talk about a guy named Rudolf Virchow and how really, really smart people can come to really, really bad conclusions based on really good reasons. And I think there's some of that with Juwan. As I suggested last week, when I was on by myself, that Juwan should have not coached this year, should have taken the year off. And it seems like that's what the doctors were pretty much telling him. And it also seems he has another surgery coming on April 19th that he put off that doctors wanted to do mid-season. This was serious. What happened to him is serious stuff, life-threatening stuff. And there's no way he should have been coaching basketball, but for various bad reasons, which he thought were good reasons, he decided to do it. And in the end, I think, you know, it probably cost him his job. The other thing about the article that's truly interesting is his version of the Sanderson story, which feels a little more compelling to me than the Sanderson version for a variety of reasons, which I won't get into here. But it goes back to something I've been saying on this show for 10 years and taken a lot of criticism for, and that it's a Rashomon-esque world. And that you never know what really went on until you hear everybody's side of the story and until you truly get the chance to ask everybody questions. And so the Sanderson issue was not quite, I believe, in my opinion, as portrayed originally. And maybe you'll think otherwise once you read the article, but I would say at least read Brennan's article because it is interesting. Also interesting on the NIL front and other things that Juwan was enduring over the last year. So
I found it to be interesting. Article dropped this morning, so I have kind of skimmed it a couple times. Yeah. I haven't had the thorough deep dive to really read through. I have pulled a few quotes that we've discussed here on the show. Mm-hmm. Funny, I was actually going to start talking hockey.
Hockey is more fun. So.
But we, as we are able to now bring Seth back into the conversation. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Seth. It was right when we said hello to you, you disappeared. So great to have you back.
Yeah, man. I was just power outage real quick. Pop back off, and the internet took a moment to get back on again.
Okay.
Technology is great until it fails you, and it fails you when you need it the most. All right, we will get to hockey a little bit later on. Obviously, that is the celebratory conversation. The next part, I was going to ask you guys what your thoughts were, how Dusty May's doing in his first nearly week on the job. So let's jump to the basketball conversation. Brian, you guys did have that write-up on the site yesterday. What are your thoughts as we're approaching a week on the job for Dusty May?
Well, it seems like he's made two of his assistant hires. Akeem Miskadeem, who's from Georgia, worked with him at Florida Atlantic, a guy who has a reputation as a high major recruiter who is apparently was on the verge of recruiting Connie Ruth's to Georgia, which is quite a feat because Georgia, you know, historically has not had much of a program. And then they also hire Boynton, I forget his first name, Mike Boynton, the former Oklahoma State head coach, who had a kind of middling tenure at Oklahoma State. You know, made the tournament once, the NIT a couple more times, but you go look at his KenPom profile and a couple of things stand out. One is that he was one of those teams in the Big 12 that's like 8-10 because the Big 12 is an absolutely brutal basketball conference. And what you see a lot is you see him finish in the top 50 in KenPom, and then because of the record, because of the strength of schedule he has, that they didn't make the tournament. And then the thing that jumped out to me is before this year, he had three top 20 defenses in a row. And before that, he had a top 50 defense. So he's a guy who might be sort of the Yaklich role. But the difference between Boynton and Yaklich is that, you know, Yaklich was just this guy who you know, was a high school teacher and came up and didn't really have a ton of connections across college basketball, which is fine. And Boynton is the guy who got Cade Cunningham to Oklahoma State. And I think more impressive than that is, you know, they were embroiled in this FBI investigation. They were actually the only team to cop a serious punishment from it, despite the fact that other teams were doing basically the exact same thing. And the thing that they got dinged for was the fact that one of their assistants was taking bribes to funnel guys to certain agents, which doesn't help you competitively at all. And probably is a detriment competitively because you've got this guy who's like, oh yeah, you need to talk to this agent instead of like, hey, let's play basketball. but so they have this kind of lull after the Cade Cunningham year. And then his freshman class this year had Eric Daly in it and a top 50 center. And I don't know if Michigan fans remember Eric Daly, but Juwan Howard was after him. He's a top 40 player. And the reaction from the coaching community, the scouting community, was universally, this guy is going to kill it at Michigan. So that's a guy who May did not have a previous relationship with, went outside his comfort zone, found a guy who everybody thinks is a really good dude. That's one thing that really jumped out. Like, he posted a video after he was let go, just kind of thanking Oklahoma State fans. And the reaction in it from not just Oklahoma State fans, but also Oklahoma fans in replies to this was really almost bizarre. They're like, everybody loves this guy. And that's kind of, yeah. And it seems like that's the same thing that everybody says about Dusty May. Like, nobody has a bad word to say about either of these guys. So he's not exactly going out and finding assistant versions of Bob Huggins, who can, right? Like, he's like doing the Nerado thing where it's like good guys only. And it seems like things are shaping up. Like, Michigan is likely to have a competitive roster next year. So Nellie Davis is in the portal. Vlad Golden is in the portal. It seems like Michigan is probably going to pick both those guys up as long as the NIL is right. And I'm sure that will be a major focus after the decline and fall of the previous administration. And on top of that, there's a first team all Ivy center who went into the portal named Danny Wolf, who came in with a no contact tag and almost walked on at Michigan before he decided to go to Yale. So center is the hardest thing to fill in the portal because there's just a limited number of functional guys who are 7 feet tall. And when you have a functional guy who's 7 feet tall, usually they're in huge demand by everybody. So if Michigan is able to pick up, you know, Golden, Davis, and Wolf, then you have, you know, two of your starting spots filled. You probably have power forward set because you got Cheddar coming back and you have T. Will, who has an option. You know, Namari can play that small forward spot. And then you're looking for, you know, two, three other transfers who can play the two and three. And I think Connor Asigian is a guy who Michigan will take a close look at. He was very good as a freshman. seems like he's not the best fit for what Dusty Bay, you know, wants to run. But in year one, I mean, you just kind of like, this is a functional Big Ten player who has a chip on her shoulder about Wisconsin. Let's get him. Right? So, yeah.
And Asijan grew up a Michigan fan, I believe.
Yes, because when he was torching Michigan last year, they kept posting pictures of him at Chrysler decked head to toe in Michigan gear, which was very painful.
Yes. So the interesting thing about Golden is that he is a Russian national, I believe. And so I don't think he's eligible for NIL monies. And so that may make it somewhat easier. As the Danny Wolf, he's at Yale, and so if he is leaving, it seems as he is Yale, Michigan may have some appeal to him as opposed to say Memphis, and so those two seem plausible. I've watched a number of games now of Golden, and I think some of what's said of him isn't quite accurate. But I like his game a lot. I think he's better defensively than people are giving him credit for. He's able to play just about anything off of the high ball screen. He can hard hedge, he can blitz, he can soft hedge. If you have to drop him, you can drop him. And so he is a good defender, keeps the ball high, great left hand, and can pass out of the post. So he's a player I like. For some reason, he didn't play a lot of minutes. He was like 22, 23 minutes, but maybe that fits well with Danny Wolf. Danny Wolf is phenomenal for a big guy, three-point shooter, 35%, nice-looking shot. He can handle the ball on offense. He can take the ball to the basket. I'm not sure it would be impossible to play Golden in the paint and Wolf at the four.
I just think defensively that would be a nightmare.
Defensively, it could be a nightmare. I agree with you. But I don't think it's an impossibility. We'll have to wait and see, you know. But in any event, if they could get both those guys, you're right, Brian, they solve their center problem. And then everything else is solvable except for point guard. I mean, it looks like Brooks will come in. He's a player I really like. Everything about him is really good, is a good defender, except for his 3-point shooting, which is, you know, not great, but probably no worse than Frankie Collins or X or McDaniel. But freshman point guard are always problematic, as that's something both you guys, I think, have pointed out in the past.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and then if they get Miskadine in, well, I think that's actually been announced, people are saying.
I don't think either has been announced, has it?
Neither has been announced, but it's been reported.
Yes, okay.
So then you have a pretty good shot at getting Connie Ruth's back in the class.
Yeah, he's a three.
He's a three or a four, and he might be a four for Dusty May. And then, so if you get Roots back, and then I think I would poke around a couple of the FAU decommits, because their entire class decommitted. I'm particularly interested in Elijah Elliott, who's like 6'4", gets described as really twitchy, and has like the sizzle reel of him playing perimeter defense that looks like he's absolutely hell to play against. Now, he's ranked 185th by 24/7, so there are a lot of limitations that are going to come with that, because 6-foot twitchy guys who play great defense don't get ranked 185 unless their offensive game is rudimentary. But to me, you get this guy, you have him shoot 500 threes a day for a couple years, and then you have Sean D. Brown. So, like, you know, when Beeline came in, he picked up Zach Novak, he picked up Stu Douglas. Neither of those guys had a Power 5 offer except for Michigan, and they're program legends. So, like, I am not opposed to May following up with a couple of those recruits who just shook loose and seeing if they're interested, because Michigan is going to have a lot of transfers this year, and they're going to have a couple of one-and-done transfers, and they're going to have a couple guys who might have a couple years. To lay a foundation, you need those like 11 through 13 spots on the roster to be filled with guys who are going to be around for a while. And I feel like guys Dusty May already recruited at FAU, who are more likely than an average nobody recruit to be good solid college players, especially at the high major level, who would be willing to like go to Michigan, take a year where you might not be playing a ton, and then develop from there. That sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, it does to me too. I mean, May has talked about building from the ground up, but next year he's going to have to do both. I mean, to some extent.
One of the knocks about what are the two knocks about his FAU teams? They were small and they were not very good defensively. When you look at why they were small, it's because they were playing Jonell Davis at the four. Like they just couldn't get a power forward. So I think when you look at a guy and like, okay, how is he going to project to Michigan? One of the metrics I like to look at is how does he perform at his weaknesses, right? You know, you figure he can bring his strengths, right? You figure he can put together a four-guard lineup if he needs to, or a stretch lineup if he needs to, and his offense is going to work. But he immediately goes for a defensive assistant, and his other assistant is a guy who can help him get Kenny Ruth, who's, I think, the best power forward coming out of high school right now. So you're looking at a guy who's directly addressed, like the first moves he makes are addressing the perceived weaknesses he had at his last stop. So he's not like coming in like, okay, I'm going to make the same thing work. He's certainly understands that the challenge is a bigger level. And I don't think he was playing 4-6-4 guys because he had to. I think that's who he could get at FAU.
Yeah. There's probably some truth to that one. We'll see. I mean, like I say, I'm reasonably convinced that Golden is a good defender. And that makes me feel, and if you have a good defender at center, it becomes a lot easier to build the rest of your defense. Think John Teske, for example. I mean, it was not a great offensive player, but it was a phenomenal defender. And you could build a defense around Teske pretty easily, given what teams do these days. So to me, Golden is a key. I mean, if they can get Golden, they can piece a team together. If they can't, it becomes more problematic.
I mean, he's comparable to like Matthew Nicholson at Northwestern. He's a 7'1", fairly big guy with a slightly smaller block rate, but a higher rebound rate, and creates a little bit more of his own. I mean, I don't agree necessarily that Michigan. That him being a Russian national is going to help us because, you know, he saw Kentucky manage to get it done with Oscar Tshiebwe. But in those cases, a lot of times, it's not necessarily nobody can pay you, so therefore come to Michigan. It's a nobody can pay you legally, so go somewhere that knows how to do it.
Well, I mean, to me, it's like the FAU guys showed an extreme amount of loyalty to Dusty May because they went to the Final Four, right?
And they all could have gone elsewhere.
They all could have gone and cashed in.
Yeah.
And instead, they stayed at FAU. And there's probably some NIL that the community was able to scrounge up, but there's no way it compared to what kind of offers they're getting in the portal. So, to some extent, I think that question has already been answered about whether those guys will be loyal to Dusty May. And, you know, this is a guy who barely played at Texas Tech his first year. May unearthed him, basically. They had to go back to his film from overseas. And last year, according to Synergy, he was the number one most post-efficient player in the country with 1.2 points per possession. And to me, like, that says a lot about May's system, right? Because he's getting this guy incredible looks. Because he's not Zach Edey, right? He's playing at FAU for a reason. He's a good player, and he's going to be in high demand. But his efficiency is unlikely to be higher with anyone not named Dusty May at the high major level, just because he knows the system. And if he's looking to use this year at a high major to springboard, then that seems like it would make a lot of sense. We'll see. You know, not everything is about dollars on the barrel. So
it is interesting to watch turning over. I mean, I don't think I've ever had to study a new roster in basketball. Like, we're going to have to study a new roster this coming year.
When you're at this point, we barely have a roster.
Usually the number of returners might be more comparable to the number of turnover that you used to have. Opposite of that.
Yeah. But I mean, imagine doing this not in the portal era.
I mean, you'd have walk-ons and one stars because you'd have to fill out a roster somehow.
Right, and like and Doug and Terrace would be forced to stick around, or they'd have to lose a year of eligibility. Like, or they're
people still transferred before the portal. It was just rarer.
Yeah.
You wanted to say something, Brian, and I think maybe I cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, the other possibility for the roster now is a couple of guys who decommitted from who transferred from Oklahoma State. So Daly is in the portal. And also the center, whose name is Brandon Garrison, also in the portal. So two top 50 players who had good freshman years in the Big 12. You know, Daly might not be the best fit for everything that Dusty May wants to do. He's not much of an outside shooter right now. His offensive game is a little bit primitive, but he's a great athlete, huge upside as a defender. And he's a guy who went to Oklahoma State. And there's a video of Boynton talking about like the Cade Cunningham recruitment and like what it is now. He's like, I can't work that hard anymore. And it's not going to work out because the kids are like, Coach, I love you, but it's $500,000. I'm going to take the $500,000. So,
and he talked about like this Cade Cunningham recruitment was like 4 years of staying, of being the guy who sees him the most and everything. And like,
And he like did funnel money to that family by hiring the kid's brother. And that's what he had to do in that situation because he didn't have the NIL, or at that time it wasn't NIL, it was just under the table cash. And without that, even though Oklahoma State pretty clearly isn't running with the big boys, he picks up two top 50 recruits. I wouldn't be surprised if one of them was interested in following.
Yeah. It's at this point, we're just, you could be right. At this point, we just don't know. We don't know much of anything. I mean, I'm hopeful that one or two of the FAU guys at least show up here, but I'm not counting on it. Maybe.
Yeah.
I think you feel pretty positively about that one. I think you had 80% or something, Brian.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, these guys went to the Final Four and then returned to Florida Atlantic, right?
Maybe they love Boca.
They're not, like, nobody has either of them on NBA radars yet.
Right.
And so if he's not on an NBA radar yet, then if the NIL is like in the ballpark, and I think that will be the case because Michigan is looking at a crossroads for their basketball program, right? They hire the hot coach. They hire a coach who says he spends 25 to 30% of his time on NIL. Yeah. So this isn't a guy who has reservations about the new state of college basketball. He's looking straight at it. And he's meeting with people who have the money to make this happen. I think it's going to happen. And so if the NIL is right, and Janelle Davis knows that, you know, this system is the system he looks the best in, this system, this guy is the one who plucked him from obscurity in Gary, Indiana, and made him to one of the best college basketball players in America, and he can go prove that he is that at a high major level of competition, I just think that's going to be hard for him to turn down, especially because Miskadeen is coming back. Like, that's the guy who recruited him to Florida Atlantic. So it would have to be an NIL offer from someone else that just blew Michigan out of the water. And if that happens, then, well, I think it's it bodes unwell for Michigan basketball.
I think I'm preparing myself not to win all of them, because Michigan's got a pool, I think, that's probably competitive with your average Big Ten team, which is a lot better than we've had in the past. But you also, it takes more to recruit a roster than it does to retain one. Now, I grant you, like, these FAU guys, if they're not major, you know, people, but I don't think that Michigan's going to be able to get those guys, and also maybe, like, Oakland's Trey Townsend, and they're not going to be able to focus as much on single guys just because other teams have one or two spots to fill and can probably overpay to fill that one spot that they need, whereas Michigan has a pool where they got to build an entire team out of it.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that, because, you know, the way that it happens now is that, like, you're getting your NIL, and if you don't like your NIL, you hit the portal and you're like, oh, I might return. Let's see what happens.
Right.
So, like, you're recruiting everybody every year on your roster.
Yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily that doesn't make me believe that Michigan won't be able to be competitive with these guys. I do think that a guy like Daly, who might not be like the cleanest fit, is a guy who Michigan might not prioritize as much as they prioritize a Jonnell Davis. So I feel like there's probably a couple of guys towards the top of the board they can snipe. And then that's another reason that maybe bringing in a couple of the FAU recruits is appealing, because they will not be fielding those kind of offers. And they might do that after they develop under Dusty May for a couple years, but that gives Michigan sort of that. It's kind of like signing an NHL player to an entry-level contract, getting these FAU guys. So, but yeah, we're going to start seeing some dominoes start falling. Like, I think that a couple of the transfers are going to take a little bit, because it's like, all right, we got to transfer these credits from hypothetically Yale.
And, right.
When Miles Hinton came in, he's like, ah, some of my credits from Stanford didn't transfer. And I'm like, oh my God.
But all the guys we're talking about are either graduates, which that doesn't even matter. As long as they graduate, you know.
Then it doesn't matter.
And they're all freshmen. They all, at most, have completed 2 years of college, I believe. So there may be still a question of some credits transferring. Although, again, as you said, you would hope they would transfer from Yale. But I don't think, because someone had asked, how would their transfers qualify? The issues that Michigan has had has not been about qualifying them coming in. It's about how many of their credits transfer. Right. And if you're a junior, or if you're a senior, you're not getting all your credits transferring. That's always been the issue. Shea Patterson lost a lot of credits when he transferred. And most kids are not going to do that. It's like reversing your course in college. So I think everybody, though, Brian, you're talking about either is a graduate, will be in a month or whatever, or is at most through freshman and sophomore years in college. I don't think.
Yeah, so the only guy we've been talking about who isn't either a grad transfer or is transferring after 1 year is Wolf.
Who's at Yale. And he's Yale.
Who's at Yale.
Yeah.
But,
and you'd hope.
But, yeah. You'd hope. I mean, well, we also talked about Trey Townsend, who, no, he's a grad guy, too.
But I believe
I think he's going to Michigan State.
Yeah.
And well, I think Townsend will end up at MSU.
Yeah. So, well, he's also a guy who, Greg Campy said, we can't afford to keep him. So,
yeah.
And is he a clean fit for what May wants to do? Like, his outside shooting is questionable. And, you know, Campy's real tight with Izzo.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like that's one where Michigan is probably not going to be.
Yeah. I think he's going to end up the state. Incidentally, I think that Montgomery took the
UD job.
Yep. UD job from MSU. And so Sadi is out of that. I mean, do you guys think Sadi will be back or not?
At this point, I think that's pretty unlikely, because he's already hired two of his assistants and he's probably going to bring someone from FAU, right? Like, you know, Miskadeen has experience teaching his system, but it's been a couple of years and they've been really successful. So I feel like, you know, a guy like Kyle Church, who was his associate head coach at FAU, is probably going to get the third spot.
Okay.
Anything else on basketball before we take a break and shift to hockey and celebrate beating MSU to go to the Frozen Four?
No, sir.
All right, then let's take a break. We're going to step aside, take a break. This is the MGO Blog Roundtable. We'll get to hockey on the other side here on Sports Talk 1050 WTK. The ticket.
Do you guys know the Henry Wilmore story? Speaking of Jonnell Davis. Right. There was a guy at Michigan back in the day, before you were alive, named Henry Wilmore. He averaged over 25, 26 points a game, and maybe 27 points a game in his junior year, and was a great rebounder. He was 6'3 and a half, played power forward, and was just an unbelievable rebounder at 6'3 and a half, and very clever around the basket. So his senior year, he demanded to John Orr that he play a guard, because the NBA wasn't interested in a 6'3 and a half power forward, even though that's probably what Charles Barkley was. And so Orr thought this was a bad mistake, and Orr told him, look, play power forward for me again next year, and somebody will take a chance on you. They'll pay you to figure out whether you can play guard or not. Well, Wilmore's convinced He wasn't going to do that. He wanted to play guard. So they had him play guard his senior year. It was a disaster. And he didn't, I don't think he got drafted, or if he did, that back then there was like 10 rounds to the NBA draft, but he didn't make a dent in the NBA. And so Orr's point was always, you know, you showed him for free. You couldn't play that position, whereas they would have paid you before to find out you couldn't play the position. I wonder about John L. Davis. You know, sometimes a guy who is 6'4", but a four is really a 6'4", 4. And so we'll I don't know. I can't predict. But
isn't that Ty Rogers at Illinois? Isn't he a 6'4", 4?
Yeah. And there are such people, like I say, Barkley was. And did you see about Frankie Collins?
He's in the portal again.
He's in the portal again.
Oh my right, God! So
gonna end up in high school college for like
shock. That's 8 years, I think. Yeah. He's in the portal again. So amazing. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, and do we have a point guard next year? Is there someone?
With a veteran point guard, you mean? Because
we don't. Pardon me?
Fat Fat's a point guard, Brooks.
Yeah. Darrell Brooks is the only experience.
I think the answer is no.
Yeah. Well, his teams at Florida Atlantic were not teams that had like one guy with a 40 assist rate, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
So,
I mean, technically, Jalen Gaffney was playing point. He had a 16 assist rate, and then Witherspoon had an 11 assist rate. John L. Davis was creating a bunch at 18 assist rate. So there was just their guards passing around. That's his offense. There's a bunch of tall point guardish kind of guys or combo guardish kind of guys.
Well, yeah. So I don't think that necessarily having a quote unquote point guard is key, but Davis had the highest assist rate on their team, right? And his turnover rate's a little elevated, but
turnover rate the same as his assist rate.
Yeah. So Bob Knight was never a believer in a point guard. If you look at his teams, he goes, "Nah, I don't have such a thing." He was very, he said, "I got guards."
One of the best point guards in the history of basketball on his team.
Well, Isaiah. But he always said that wasn't key for him. He said, "I want people who can handle the ball, but we don't distinguish between our lead guard and our two." Now with Isaiah, you're right; it was a different deal for those 2 years.
All right, guys, we are back on radio in about 20 seconds or so. Usually, I say I will count you back in, but I'll just bring it back in since that's kind of how this works. You know, all those people kept grumbling in the last couple of months. We're like, "Hey, let's talk a little hockey." And people are like, "Oh, hockey, I'm turning it off." I hope they're not turning it off now.
Yeah, I hope not.
Ready to talk some hockey.
We get to do this every year, right?
Hey, it's not a – I like doing these things all the time, talking Frozen Force. All right, stand by, guys. And we are back on the Michigan Insider, Sports Talk 1050, WTK, the ticket online at WTK.com. The MGoBlog Roundtable crew, Brian Cook, Seth Fisher, Craig Ross are here with me. And guys, we're going to transition from basketball to hockey. The Michigan Wolverines vanquished Michigan State. If you're only going to beat them a couple times during the year, make the last one the one time for sure that you beat them. Brian, is that the most satisfying regional final victory you've witnessed Michigan play?
Oh, God, no.
Not beating Michigan State? Who's more satisfying than knocking Michigan State out?
No, there's like, I watched Jed Ortmeier beat number one seed Denver at Yost Ice Arena. There's no comparison to playing at the St. Louis Blues practice facility.
Yeah.
Like,
but knocking off MSU doesn't rank as
coming. No, back, coming really? Absolutely not.
Maine, there are some bangers in Michigan.
It's not.
History.
Oh, I know. I've been to some of those.
My first college hockey games and tournament games were in the 90s. Like I was at the Mike Legg game. I've been to a lot of great games, but I'm talking about the opponent you beat. I don't know. Beating Michigan State to send them home crying. Maybe it's because of the fan base. Maybe it's not about the team you beat, about the fan base you beat. It just seemed extra satisfying.
I don't hate Michigan State hockey fans, though.
Oh,
well, you have a short memory. So. Well, actually, that's not even true. You can have a pretty long memory at this point and not remember what Michigan State hockey fans are like.
I remember Convoy Trop. I remember that stuff. But like, I have,
but like they've been so bad for so long that the rivalry doesn't really feel active anymore. And it was very satisfying because you're incorrect that Michigan only beat Michigan State twice this year. They won the Big Ten championship game and they had two of the most ridiculous calls I've ever seen take that away from them.
Totally correct. You're totally correct.
And the difference between, you know, playing Denver, playing some of these teams, is that I pretty much knew that Michigan was at least the equivalent of Michigan State because I saw them play six times.
Yeah.
You know, and there was at no point was it like, oh, we can't beat this team. Like, I saw that number one seed, and I'm like, this is a really good draw for Michigan. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, BC and BU are loaded to the gills with NHL prospects, and Denver is Denver.
Yeah, so of all the ones that you've been saying that, so.
So, like, of all the one seeds, like, this was the one to get. And Michigan, you know, played their game. They didn't have Seamus Casey, and there was actually a bunch of power plays, and they looked horrible on all of them because they didn't have, you know, probably the best power play quarterback in America.
He's 100%. And, he's back. He'll be fine.
Oh, is he? That's good to hear.
That was announced yesterday. He's fine.
All right.
So, you know, it was very satisfying, but, you know, it wasn't. There were other ones that just vastly outstripped it because I went into that game expecting to win it. I did not go into the Denver game expecting to win the Denver game. So,
all right. Fair point. Let's talk about that third period in particular because Michigan hasn't played a lot of third periods like that this season.
Well, so, you know, they enter the tournament with a negative goal differential in the third period, and everybody's like, da, 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 da. And then, of course, in the tournament, they score seven goals in two separate third periods to beat North Dakota and then Michigan State. So it just goes to show that, like, you know, there's nothing more random than single elimination playoff hockey.
There's a story to this, though, because early in the season, they were falling apart late in games. And we saw, I mean, they felt a little rickety again 6-5, but like starting from maybe the Notre Dame series, or if you want to go back to the state series before that, but those Notre Dame Minnesota series, they were locking it down when they got a lead. And that was not something we saw from this team most of the season. I think it speaks to the progression of Marshall Warren. I think it speaks to the just the what they focused on as a team is that this is something we have to get down. Is our 5-on-5 defense went from being a weakness to a strength, and our power play or our penalty kill defense went from being a major weakness to a strength.
Well, to some extent, I think that's true, but there's also another extent where it's just like the things that were happening in third periods were just unsustainable. From a negative standpoint, where, you know, as soon as they pulled the goalie, like, oh, they're going to score a goal every time. Like, that's not something that, you know, happens. So I do feel like, you know, I mentioned this midseason when they were 500 at the Big Ten, but they had, you know, the second best or maybe best goal differential in the league. I felt like their play was not reflected in their record. And I think that that started to reflect better as they got deeper and deeper into the season, and their play continued to improve because they are one of the youngest teams in the country, and so they should improve faster than other teams. So they improved, and then, you know, their luck swung a little bit more towards the positive, which was very helpful in the North Dakota game because most of those goals were just hot garbage for both teams until the Duke one that was the eventual winner. So, and that was the case in this one too, where it was just kind of a lot of dirty crease goals until Frank Nazar pulls out the Michigan 2.0, which a guy named Sam Stockton, who runs a site called Gulo Gulo Hockey on Substack. I mean, this was an incredible pull. Frank Nazar did that in the first game ever at Michigan. No, they didn't score on it, but he pulled out the between his legs cross ice 2-on-1 pass that got the job done. And after he posted that, I was like, I remember that. Because Nazar comes in super hyped and then he doesn't play most of his freshman year because he's been hurt. He comes back and you're like, all right, let's see what's going on here. And his first game is kind of like, you know, he's getting back in the flow of things. He's not really showing a whole lot. And then he pulls that off and you're like, hey, how about that? So probably up there with the Mike Camilleri goal against Ryan Miller in terms of like all-time goals against Michigan State.
Yeah, I was going to mention that goal too. The Camilleri goal was unbelievable. You know, I agree with Seth. I mean, the one thing that, or the two things that happened this year was, one, the penalty kill, which did seem sketchy early on, really has become a strength of the team and not a weakness, or at least good and not a weakness. Case is out. Yeah, and early in the year, for a good chunk of the year, we had a terrible time, I felt, clearing the puck out of our defensive end, and that seemed to get better and better, and a lot of that, I think, was Warren, but other guys, too, seemed to, I mean, you know who I thought played well this weekend, you guys can tell me if I'm wrong, is Holtz. I thought Holtz was really solid, and he had to step up, in particular, because you didn't have Casey. And so those two things, I think, have gotten better. And beyond that, it's been sort of typical of Michigan, where they start the season slow and then they get a little better. And then all of a sudden they pick it up. And then at the end of the season, they're, you know, they're what we'd hoped they would be. You know, I think from a macro view, you have to give Ward credit too. I mean, Ward takes a lot of crap from me, from everybody else, but yeah, I think he made a really good hire in Brandon Nerado.
He just waited that one out.
I credit him for Dusty May. I think he did a great job with Dusty May. I'm not here to knock Ward today, but like,
there was pressure on Ward to keep Mel. There was pressure on Ward from alums and some prominent alums to keep Mel, and he didn't.
Yeah, but your job as the athletic director is to make the decision when you have the information to make the decision, not wait 4 months, get boxed in, have to hire an interim, see him make the final four with Adam Fantilli, and then hire him. That is not a credit to Ward Manuel in any way whatsoever. If he had promptly axed Mel and gone with Nerado, fine. But that's not what he did. You can't give him credit for sitting on a report that eventually got Mel Pearson fired for 4 months, well, and then watched Michigan State become a one seed with a decommit goalie from Michigan who left when Michigan may or may not have had a head coach.
All right, I go back to my sand.
And the Regents had something to do with that too. Let's get back to this team because it's not on to that side note. It didn't need to.
We'll
keep it to this team and what's going on here. But Craig, I could go off on a tangent too. I don't want to go off on any tangents here. So let's the Michigan hockey team obviously heading to the Frozen Four. I know next week Sam's going to get a little bit more into it with you guys, but I'm kind of curious, Brian and Seth and Craig, the evolution, the progress that Barcheski's made in net. He made some phenomenal saves down the stretch, and I know that. I mean, they hung him out to dry in those power plays in particular the last game, but he's made some pretty nice saves. I'm just curious, his progression throughout the season, what you've seen out of him.
Well, he had a kind of questionable stretch run. So Michigan was playing some games, and they were in tight games, but the reason they were in tight games is that Barcheski was giving up some questionable goals. You know, the flip side of that is he absolutely robbed a couple of Notre Dame players in that series that clinched their bid in. Again, it's the third period. The goalie's out for the opposition. They're definitely going to score, and Barcheski just robbed him. And it's really hard to talk about progression for goalies, because if you go to the NHL and you look at a season-long save percentage, you're like, does this mean anything? And the math people say, not really. You need like two or three seasons before you can say anything about a goalie. And that's with an 82-game season. So what we know about Barcheski is he's played a lot at Canisius, and he has, you know, the save percentage in the 910, 920 range. And that's basically what he's performed at. And he's a solid goalie. He's not, you know, a Richter Award finalist type guy. But he's a guy who came in and really held it down for Michigan when they had no idea what they were going to get at goalie after Portillo turned pro. So, you know, I think he's done well. I think he is, you know, not a guy who's ticketed for a pro future, but that doesn't have to be everybody's destiny. So he's been solid.
Yeah.
I know that within the program, people have told me that they love Barcheski. They love what he's done this year. And I think that's with the caveat that, that Brian just expressed. But I know inside of the program, they've been very happy with his play.
I think I'm sorry. One of those weird things where, like, statistically, it's very hard to determine who he is. And then your eyes will tell you immediately who he is. Because you, when you see like a Dom Hasek or a, you know, Roberto Luongo, or like, you know, in Michigan history, you know, you saw, you know, a Turco or whatever, you saw some of the stars, they get in net and you're like, wow, that guy's good. Or sometimes you see a guy and he's just like, okay, this guy's solid. You get a feel for the dude. And I think Barzo, he came in, he looked like a B-level goalie. When I think that his profile was, you know, are we going to get a C or a B guy? And that's what they needed. They needed somebody who could play B level. Now, every goalie is going to get opportunities to, like, just shut somebody down, and they're going to get opportunities to screw up and have bad goals go in. The number of bad goals that go on him is not zero, but it's also not terrible. He's not going to, you know, he doesn't have the size of Portillo. He doesn't have the athleticism of, you know, even of a Blackburn. But he's a solid goalie, and going from Noah West to that was a huge reason why why this team was able to kind of get back in the playoff picture and get to where they are.
He raised their ceiling. So last question. I know Sam's going to get more into this next week because obviously the Frozen Four game will be a week from today, so the day you guys are back on. But I will not be here next week. And Brian, you said some very concerning things. You basically said the Boston schools are loaded and Denver is Denver. So does Michigan have a shot then next week on Thursday when I'm coming back from down south? Or I come home in time to watch this hockey game. Do they have a shot to win this game?
Well, yeah, chip in a chair. That's what this tournament is, right? Like I remember having a conversation with Sam before Michigan played North Dakota a few years back. And I was like, North Dakota is incredible and Michigan's in tough. And then what happened is that, you know, Sean Hunwick stole that game. And I don't think Michigan is going to be in a position where they would need a Sean Hunwick performance from Barzo. When they're not going to get one. That's the best goalie game I've ever seen at Michigan. But, you know, they can play with these guys. Now, I think that Boston College has much more high-end talent. I mean, you know, BU has the guy who's going to be the number one pick in this draft. But you know who the number two pick in this draft is supposed to be? It's Artem Leshchenov. So, you know, Michigan State isn't as loaded to the gills as the Boston schools are this year. But I watched those guys play in this tournament. And, you know, Alex had a really perceptive tweet where he said something along the lines of, like, you know, Boston College just isn't playing very well, but they have like one shift a period where they just go Harlem Globetrotters on you. And that's about right. So, you know, Michigan is, I think, the least, they have the longest odds to win the national title. And I think that's fair. But, you know, they're about 20% if you game out all the odds. And that's, you know, chip in a chair. It's a single elimination hockey tournament. Yeah, they got a chance.
I got us at better than 20% in this game. I mean, I agree BC's probably a better team, but they're not that much better. And it is hockey. As you said, it's one, you know, hockey in a one game. You know, most anything can happen, especially when you've got the ability that Michigan has. So, Michigan has more than a puncher's chance here. My opinion.
Guys, appreciate it as always. Sam, we'll be back with you next week here in the air chair on the MGO Blog Roundtable. Appreciate you guys filling it up as always. We'll be talking more hockey, of course, next week. I'm guessing that by next week, maybe a little bit of, we'll definitely have resolution on Dusty's coaching staff officially, I'm sure, by next week. But as far as the roster, hopefully we'll have more news to discuss with you guys.
Maybe Frankie Collins will be our point guard by next week.
And not our point guard again the week after.
Yeah. See you guys next week. This has been the MGO Blog Roundtable here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA Ann Arbor, Accumulus Station.